I want to welcome you to the Drag Champ Show. The three amigos are leading this show, none other than Jake Hodge, Mr. Hoodrich, Ryan Gleghorn, and Gary Don Free, Mr. Drag Champ himself. Now, I wouldn't ride to the store with these three yahoos, but you put them together for some good old stories, some racing news, some results from all over the world. Now, that's a party you just don't want to miss. So, let's tune in, let's hang on, and let's get it on. I want to welcome you to the Drag Champ Show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have a special treat for you. Our guest is a legend of the sport. He's a two-time NHRA Supergas World Champ, Mr. King Kong himself, Sheldon Gecker. How are you, bud?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. As Jake said, I have my hero on the line, so it's awesome to be able to talk to you on the podcast.
The guys in our sport have a lot of heroes. You probably have a bunch of them. So do I.
I think we all do. We talked to Edmund Richardson, I don't know, yeah, not long ago. And he's part of that episode was talking about people that impressed him. It was kind of cool to listen to him talk about some of the other, you know, greats of the sport and how he thought about that. And so definitely great to have you on, man. So for a lot of our listeners may or may not be familiar with you. You haven't raced as much in the last probably 5 or 6 years, but one of only two gentlemen to ever win two Supergas World Championships. You've made a living driving a race car for pretty much the majority of your life, I believe. So tell us kind of how did you determine or when did you determine that you wanted to be a race car driver? How'd that start and where did it go?
It's probably pretty much like everybody else. It probably stemmed from street racing with hot rods back in, that would be the early 70s. And we got to the point where the street racing thing was getting pretty competitive and there wasn't a lot of places to do it. And had a friend that owned a service station down the street. It was an Exxon, or I think they called it Enco at the time. I can't remember what they were. And it was a competitive thing. He said, hey, I got a Dodge Dart. Let's go to track. I think I can beat your 440. So we ended up going to the track, and we ended up racing all night, and I beat the hell out of them. And after that, I got hooked. And after that, I brought the thing home. They said, you know, there's being at the track, I was exposed to the sport that I was never exposed to before. This is my first time actually competing at the track. So I took the thing home. I says, you know what? We're going to tear this thing down and make a formula stock run, which is equivalency of somewhere between stock eliminator and super stock type class, HRA class back in the 70s. And that's how it all started. So it started out by running a class type car, similar to stock eliminator without a breakout. I think we did that about 7 years before he got into bracket racing and then stumbled into bracket racing, which liked it a lot more. And ended up when the super categories came around, filtered into that thing only because it was it paid a little bit more. Or ended up paying a little bit more.
So that was kind of your reason to go from class racing to bracket racing, right?
It was amazing. Because we'd be there, we'd have 40 or 50 cars, and he had a good car count in this formula stock thing. And about the time I was able to win in this category and do really well, the thing like paid like $500 to win. But I'm watching these bracket guys over here at the same track. They're winning $1,000 or $2,000 with the same car count. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. Why don't we do that? So we took the exact same car and moved it over there and even did better over there. And that's back when pretty much most of the cars, late 70s, were still stick shift cars. The turbo cars, the torque plate cars weren't as competitive. Pre-trans brake, they didn't have trans brakes at all back then. So when you would power brake the car or foot brake the car to get the RPM up high enough to get a proper light, roll it in, knock out the top light, whatever you're going to do, you're putting the car into a bind, especially with a four-link car or ladder bar car. It didn't work quite as well. So the stick-shift cars were more popular up until probably around 80-ish when the trans brakes became perfected by the people building them. And then it was a whole different ballgame. Everything changed.
So when was the stock and the bracket racing? When did you kind of get started? What year was that?
72. I field stripped the 72 RT. And changed everything in it and used all max wedge parts in it at about 413 inches with a Chrysler process transmit, new process transmission, Dana rear end. Still had the leaf springs, the pinions number, all the ancient stuff. You know, redid all the front end parts. It was a nice race car for the time, but I got my ass kicked every week by the small block Chevrolet. So that went on for like 7 years and until we were able to make enough power. Actually, we didn't actually make any more power. We changed cars. So we got away from the RT and put all the same drive line into a Barracuda at the same weight. And the damn thing was like half a second faster for whatever reason. I don't know, it was aerodynamics or motor placement. It was way faster car. ran that for a while and took that car into the bracket classes. It was a really good bracket car back then. It's probably a still good bracket car now, but we were attracted by that because about that time, that's when the big payout bracket races were starting, where Ron Leek in Byron, Illinois had the cash nationals, and that sucker paid $10,000 to win. And a lot of times, the first year or two, if you got to the second round, you got a check for $300. I mean, up until you were getting 400 cars, that's what it was. And the round money was excellent at the time. It was, you know, it was like $10,000, $5,000, $2,500, $1,200, $600, $300. So it paid about 32 cars, I believe, which they don't do that anymore. But it wasn't as top heavy as it is now. But and you'd have guys from all over the country coming to this thing. You know, you'd have 400 cars from all over the United States, except for the West Coast. But, you know, everybody from the Southeast and Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas. It's a pretty decent race. Tough race, too.
So bracket racing looked a lot different back then. You mentioned, you know, stick shift to kind of light and stuff like that. But they didn't even have reaction times since what?
Yeah.
Come in the early 80s, maybe? I mean,
right.
A lot of people didn't even understand that.
Oh, God, I would hate it when he brought that stuff in, too, because now all of a sudden everybody got smart. Everybody figured out, well, man, and about that time, it was just before that time that everybody was deep staging, knocking out the top light. They staged a car leading about 2,800 RPM. A lot of guys would use General Motors fast idle switches, roll it, hit the button, and bring the idle up 2,800. But, you know, it just made a lot of guys that didn't understand it really competitive. The thing with the stick shift is that there's less multiplication in a stick shift transmission than there is in a torque converter transmission. So if you can shift it pretty much the same every time and keep the clutch gap about the same, you're going to have a pretty consistent light. And that was the art to it. And the Folk brothers up in Illinois were really good at that. Ron Folk. I mean, I never saw a guy win so many races in my life. It was almost unbelievable. But they practiced that art. And then later on, as they say, went to trans brakes and reaction timers, and then everybody got competitive. And about that time, we had the super categories coming, which got pretty tough, too. The super categories took all the best racers from all the divisions and brought them to the NHRA, and that was their plan, and it did work. Now they do the opposite. They just want to get rid of them. But talk about that later.
So when did you start – when Supergas when was it a class, like 82?
I think 81 was contested at – I think it was Gainesville first.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I think it was 10-10 is what it was. And I think it stayed 10-10 for the first season. And then 82, I think it went to 990. And I started about 82. I think I built a car in 81. Okay. I built a car specific for that category, not using a stock eliminator car or super stock car. It was a super stock car. It actually worked pretty good. We built actually a car for it. And I think that was why I had an advantage for a while. I was a little bit ahead of the construction curve for a little bit in the beginning.
Charger that you built?
Yeah, a little Omni Charger thing.
Mm-hmm.
Good visibility, relatively aerodynamic, short wheelbase, but it was a ladder bar, so you didn't have to drive it real hard. You didn't seem to be afraid of any type of horsepower. You could run it as hard as you want. But, you know, back then, you know, what do we have? I mean, the best motor I was ever in that car had, what, 860? And the motor that I won the most races with had 775. So I guess if you can run the index, you can do plenty good.
Was that like a 440?
It was a 400. Okay. With a 440 crank. So it'd be 452 inches. So it was a shorter deck Chrysler. And the shorter deck Chryslers are a little more durable because there really isn't a four bolt in those things. But since you put the short deck in it, the rotating weight gets cut way down. The thing runs a hell of a lot faster than the 440s. And plus the bore size, because of President Nixon, was they turned those things from 383s to 400s. So the bore size was actually bigger than the 440. So you get some free cubic inches out of it. There's a pretty durable motor. The problem was with the Chrysler stuff was the availability of cylinder heads that made decent power. You know, back then, the Chevrolet stuff, even the big block Chevy stuff, the 427 stuff, cylinder heads, well, it's still a good head. You know, if you ever put them on a flow bench, they're pretty decent, you know. And Chrysler didn't have that except for the max wedge stuff, unless you wanted the Hemi thing, but I wasn't ready to go there. I think I couldn't even lift it. You know, it's just a heavy motor, but. It was a good combination. The real good combinations at the time were probably short stroke motors. And I think that's because they didn't screw the tires off the car. We didn't have tires as big as we do now.
All right. So I got several different questions from that, because the little Omni was when I first became aware of who Sheldon Gecker was and the King Kong. So, but before that, all your racing up until recently has really been all Dodge. So is that what you grew up loving, Dodges, or did you just start with a Dodge and stayed with it?
Yeah, no, I think I started with a 54 Chevy. I hated the car. And then I just hated it. And then I had a 55 Oldsmobile, and I did like that. I think it really started back. My dad had an old 57 Plymouth, which wasn't bad. I think it started when, so I got married, first wife, and I decided to buy a car. So I'm sitting, I'm looking at this huge car lot, and there's a 66 Satellite with a 383 four-speed, right? So I go over and drive it. It's a nice car. I'm going to buy it. While I'm leaving the car lot, across the street, there's another small car lot. This guy's got a 61 Chrysler Leonard Series car, a G car sitting on a lot, red. So I'm going to look at this thing. So I went and looked at it. It was twice as fast as the 383 car. It had 413 cross ram, 2 4 bells, solid lifter cam, got the rocker arms from the factory. This is what Chrysler did back in the day. It's just a really four bucket seats, beautiful car. I bought that. And I think that's where I got hooked. I think I was done then. So if it was a Chevrolet, maybe a 409, which I had one of those too, maybe I would have been doing that. But I guess I was impressed with that car. And I actually bought two more of them. I used one for street racing, I should say. And the other one I just drove. But that's how I got started. That's how I got hooked in it.
Yeah, y'all had a lot cooler cars, which was when I was in the mid-80s, we had like 305s and a Z28 or 302 and a Mustang GT. We didn't have any of that cool stuff.
Yeah, they don't make it anymore. Well, they are. I mean, the car companies are doing their best trying to keep up with the performance industry. That's why I don't understand why drag racing is suffering right now. All the automotive companies are making hot rods. I don't know why we're not getting them at the track, unless we don't have a class for them or what's going on.
I think on the Friday nights, you're seeing, you know, and Ryan may be able to attest to this, but on the Friday night stuff, I think in Houston, it's full of those cars. I know.
Really?
They just do like, they're not bracket racing them. They're just testing, tuning, grudge racing, whatever they're doing, just making laps. But I think they're full of those Dodge, you know, Hellcats and Challengers and some of that, the Mustangs and stuff like that.
Yeah. Ryan, really, I guess it's our area, and I've seen it in Houston too, the Chevy pickups, they're still...
Really? The S10s? Yeah.
Not even the S10s, but like just like 2000 to 2005 Silverados.
Right, right.
Like they do LS swaps and all sorts of stuff to those, and I see more of that than anything.
Yeah, LS is a pretty decent motor.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's definitely gotten rid of the old small block Chevrolet. It's completely taken over, so...
Right. If you look at it real hard, it's actually a Chrysler with distributor in the back. You know, if you look at it really hard.
There's a true Mopar guy coming out for you, Ryan.
Yeah, it actually does look. And this was pointed out to me by a Chevrolet guy, you know.
Okay.
So how come he turned this thing into a Chrysler? Well, actually, the Chrysler motor that we run is, that was actually supposedly, according to Larry Henry, who was the Chrysler guy at the time, he said that motor was bought from Packard back in the 40s, that design. So, I always had a feeling that all the motors, I mean, the small block Chevy is really similar, very, very similar to big block Chrysler. And Duntoff was the guy who designed the small block Chevy. I get a feeling that Duntoff designed them all because there's too many similarities between a lot of these motors, even the Pontiac motor. You look at a Pontiac and you look at a Chrysler, wait a minute, didn't the same guy make this motor? You know, you don't know.
Maybe so.
They all hung out together.
So you sound extremely knowledgeable mechanically. So is that part of the advantage you had back in the days, or is that because you owned a service station, right?
Yeah, probably. And we had 11 cars or 12 cars running out of the gas station. So I learned from the guys that hung out there because they were running a lot of it. And most of them were Chevrolets, and they were running a lot of that stuff. So everybody learned together. We had a good group of guys that, you know, some of them raced pretty good. Some of them were really good racers, like Hipster from Automatic Trans Design. Those guys are really good. You know, and we had a couple of police officers, an engineer, a state patrol cop. I just talked to one last week. He lives in Burlington, Wisconsin, and now his son's got a car, which is a good thing. His son's interested in the sport. So it was good. It was a good thing. I think we did. But these guys didn't have a place to work on their stuff, so we let them work on it there. You know, and they work on it outside or inside when he could. And a lot of times we'd be done. You know, we were open all night for a while, but for a while we close at midnight. At midnight, they bring all their stuff and start working on it. So we didn't get home till like 4 or 5 in the morning sometimes. And I would always show up at 10 o'clock at work, start answering the phones, and then the same thing every day after day after day. But it was fun. It was enjoyable. And these guys did pretty well. And that was, I think we still see a lot of that now, but we've lost a lot of those guys because of the cost of the sport. You know, it's really sad. And here in this part of the country, we lost the tracks. You guys got it good down there.
So you're in Arizona now, correct?
In Surprise, Arizona. It's the northwest suburb. we had a nice little track over here on a down the street from me called Speed World. And they was on a 99-year lease, and a guy operating it didn't do a very good job, and the BLM took it back, but it's sitting there empty right now. A quarter mile track.
Yeah, but you grew up in Wisconsin, correct? Or is that where the racing started?
Correct. Yeah, Milwaukee, northwest side of Milwaukee. So we would race at Union Grove, Wisconsin, Byron, Illinois. What else do we have there? Cordova. There was a terrible track in Cordova. You guys got way better tracks than that one. But Byron was a pretty decent track. That's where I learned the art of bracket racing, is racing at Byron, Illinois. Them guys were good. Those guys were still, they're still good. You know, well, the folks used to race there.
You mentioned the dad, but the sons are still
sons are killer. They're good. They're all good. It's genetic. You know, it's them guys are great. You know, and they're a good bunch of guys too. You know, but the whole family for a while, I think, raced. I think it was about four of them, I think. And the kid, now the kids race. So they had the four brothers and the kids. So it just, that track was for sale for a while. I think I saw an advertisement on the side of a funny car one time.
It still is.
It's a decent little track, except it has winter.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, they've done a really good job of keeping up with the place. And it kind of, I was there last year, and it still feels just as historic. You know, you feel like it's kind of like Indy on Monday. It's like hallowed grounds whenever you get there.
Right, right.
And, you know, of course, they did an awesome job of honoring Mr. Leak last year whenever they had the race before the 1.1 million. I forget what they called it, but
the Firecracker Nationals, is that their big race?
Yep. The Firecracker Bracket
Nationals. $100,000 to win.
Right. Yeah. Right. BJ Van Ness owns it right now, and it's for sale, but that place is, I mean, it is incredible.
Yeah, BJ, when I was there, BJ couldn't have been 16 years old, and he was running the place back then. You know, and use the correct word. It was hallowed ground. Yeah. And a lot of these tracks that have closed are hallowed ground. They need to be resurrected.
We're talking about racetracks, and the article that you did with Drag Champ, you talked about Sanair. What was it about Sanair that made it your favorite place? Because
I have no idea.
I've got a lot of Canadian friends that they talk about Sanair a lot, and they've had a lot of success there as well.
Well, it was an all asphalt track, if I remember correctly. I don't remember when he ever put a concrete pad in it. And the pit area was halfway decent. Visibility from the stands to the track were good. It was pretty. It was visually a pretty track. The guy that owned it lived at the end of it in a five-story phallic-type house, a big, tall, skinny house, and he had tigers in it or lions or something. He lived with a fence around it. I can't remember the fella's name. He owned a beer company, apparently. But when I started racing up there, I met a whole bunch of people and have a whole bunch of friends that I still have today in the area. Just a good group of people. I mean, half of them I couldn't understand are from Quebec. But good racers, though. They loved the sport, but they couldn't contest it because of all the import tax on all the products that came into the country. And they only had, you know, Naperville and Sanair, and there was a little track in outside of Ottawa. They didn't have many tracks to race, but it was a good, really good group of racers.
Luskville,
that's it. There's a railroad track that goes between is it a water box and a starting line? I'm trying to think. Or right behind the water box.
What was it?
A railroad track. Some railroad tracks. And then the shutdown was short enough that they occasionally drove through the fence onto the highway, you know. But
Lusville got a makeover this last year. They got new asphalt in the pit area and track resurfaced. And
oh, wow.
It was needed. There was a time where you could see, you know, if there was a photographer, you know, the mile an hour cone, if you take a picture at the 330, you can see cars coming off the ground. But
oh boy.
But it all got touched up, and I think bracket racing in Canada is coming back around.
Yeah, they've got at least two really strong bracket series up there. Was it Cassius King is one, and Jake may know more, but they've got several really strong bracket programs that pay really good, and I think they have some pretty good car counts up there as well. So
yeah, I don't know what the Cassius King is, but I'm familiar with the Super Tour.
Super Tour.
Was there one in Great Bend? Was there also that track?
Grand Bend.
Yeah. Yep. I've been there once.
Yeah.
That's a big facility too. But that stuff in Canada, the reason they couldn't race it because he couldn't afford the product. I mean, the product was inflated at 33% tariff coming across the border. So a lot of racers in this country, won't mention any names, would smuggle the stuff in for the guys so they could race. You know, they hide in their trailers and in their motorhome seats and stuff like that. I wouldn't know who that would be.
Jake does that now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I made the mistake one time of coming across the border in New York, and I was I couldn't fit between the standard toll booth lanes. I thought I was too wide. I was in the motorhome and stacker, So I just pulled over in the tour bus lane and parked, and you'd have thought I had a bomb in that thing as fast as it came out. What are you doing over here? Really? We don't belong here. And that was like a 3-hour customs visit.
Was that Quebec or is that
Ontario? coming from Quebec, going to
right.
Rockingham.
Right. They got metric roads or something. The roads are thinner. I swear, when we were in Montreal, I thought it was going to hit everybody on both sides of me. Either that or all the cars imported to Canada are narrower. I don't know. You know, it was very, very small roads, very, very congested.
What I learned was you should have given them the T-shirts at the beginning of the inspection. It would have ended a lot sooner.
Did he question you about who won when you got to the border?
No, we were on our way there. They were asking me why I was driving some French guy's motorhome when I'm clearly American.
Okay. Yeah. Right. You look like a terrorist. That's right.
Then they asked me, you know, do you have more than $10,000 cash in here? I'm like, well, no. And I get to Rockingham, and I called him and said, hey, I made it. I need to go get, I forget what it was. And they said, oh, there's some cash in the drawer next to the driver's seat. There was quite a bit of money in there, probably more than I was supposed to have. So luckily, I didn't look there.
Well, it's a funny place. And then, you know, if you have weapons, that's even worse. And Mike Henderson went to Canada once. He's a racer out of Washington, passed away a couple of years ago. And he went across the border, and he asked if he had any weapons. And he had to think about it for a while. I said, well, yeah, actually, I do. He had to go look for it to find it. And then he arrested him.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So now he can't get back into Canada.
So when did the racing for a living really start? Because it sounds like you were racing that we talked yesterday, and you were talking about racing 3-4 nights a week. I mean, that's almost racing for a living if you have a regular job. So,
well, that was the bracket racing stuff, and that was fun. I mean, it's you know, especially, you know, we even on a week to week basis, we were getting some big names up there. Occasionally, Johnny LaBoost would come up and hang out for a couple of weeks and enter two cars in one category and actually end up running himself in the semifinals, you know. But I think after that, I think what happened is I tried to make this thing work with a torque plate in the car on the foot brake, and it got pretty close. I was getting my ass kicked, and it was Joe Covert. I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure he stole my transmission and he left a power glide. And I put the power glide in the car against my better judgment because I'm a Mopar guy, right? So I put the power glide in the car. Well, the whole world changed overnight. And it wasn't like a fresh, brand new double wazoo power glide. It was one that was sitting under somebody's bench, had dirt on it, right? With a trans brake. And so we put that thing in, I think was 84 about this time. So I was struggling about a couple years with it. And we went to Las Vegas, and I made – out of 11 times, I think 5 or 6 of them were a 90 would change with that transmission, with the 775 horsepower car on 1220, 3125 tires. So I figured, well, I'm an idiot. I should have done this a long time ago. I should have listened to the people around me. About the next year, we won Montreal, and the people from Felpro were there, and Felpro is interested in starting a new gasket line, which is their performance line now. And he wanted some cars at the track. So they contacted one of the guys that pitted with us, contacted them, a Dennis Clote, a Joe Covert, and I, and they sponsored us for many years before they got bought out by corporate America to try to advertise their product, which was a really good product. And it still is, you know, and that's how we got it started. So now that I put a little bit of cash in the hopper. So now I'm going to these races, and there was like a period of time that I was angry when I didn't win the race because we were doing so well. I left the service station to get run by my friend, who was a better mechanic than me anyway. And I went out and raced for 85, 86, 87, 88, 89, almost full time with that combination, 89 racing super comp with that little Omni, and all the rest of the times racing super gas. And I got to tell you, I think it was 87, I netted $60,000 racing. And I'm not as good as some of the other guys that I bracket race with. I'll tell you that. I mean, I still think to the day there's guys that I bracket race that were better than I was, but I may had a better combination for those few years, the way the sport was. Well, now the sport's entirely different. You got to enter a top alcohol dragster and a funny car in a class. I mean, let's face it, there are guys in super comp right now that are actually running faster in top fuel in the early 80s, you know?
Yep.
So it's all different. It's but money
you also-
now.
I mean, back in the 80s, if you won, you talked about winning in Montreal and stuff. What did you win for a national event back then?
16 to 20.
And what did you get? A flatbed trailer, I would assume, at most of the cases, at a pickup truck? Or maybe a small enclosed?
Well, not even enclosed. The first time in Montreal was a small motorhome and an open trailer. The next year, I think we did win the next year too, was the motorhome. And the next year, I think we ran Nick Iarussi with Godzilla in the finals. That was the race of the century, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And the most competitive supercast racer of all time. And I got to race him in the final in Montreal.
Yeah, that was an iconic race with you two guys, for sure.
Yeah,
but yeah,
crazy.
I mean, that's what people don't understand is back then you literally could have a pickup truck and a flatbed and you go off and win 15 to 20. Well, back then, 15 to 20 would carry you the whole year for travel expenses and racing.
You're exactly
you want
right.
anything else, you were profitable.
$1.33 a gallon, $1.20 a gallon. You know, you were making money. And plus our stuff lasted longer because we weren't buzzing it. Well, I was buzzing it, but most of the guys weren't buzzing it, you know, 6,800. I was buzzing mine 75, 76 because it was more consistent. But I mean, back to it's a wedge Chrysler is kind of like a big small block Chevy. The valve's not very heavy. You can run that valve spring all. I never changed a lifter. Matter of fact, anytime I ran a Chrysler, I never changed a lifter. When I ran the Chevrolets, and I did run some Chevrolets for years, which I had very good luck with them, I was always changing lifters. I was scared to death, you know. I can't figure that one out, by the way. Why I'm changing lifters and those things. I'm oiling the hell out of them too.
Yeah. Well, everybody started putting those, restrictors in those, when they put the roller cams in them, they were burning up the roller cams. And my dad was every time he had somebody come in the shop, the engine shop, he would pull those things out. He'd take a drill bit and enlarge the hell out of them, stick them back in, never say a word. Cause he's like, all they're going to do is burn shit up.
I did almost the same thing. I did it once. And then after that, I pulled it out completely. I just left it out. The oiling system and those things are plenty good. We don't rev them high enough to hurt them, you know?
So where did the King Kong name come from? That was one of the questions I can't let you get
away from. That was a dumb thing. I mean, back in the time, all these guys that ran in our class, they all had their name on the side of the car. I don't know if it was an egotistical thing or what, but, Jim Smith on the side of one car and Tony Christian on the side of the other car. It doesn't seem, I don't know. I'm not there yet. I'm the guy that doesn't have the chrome wheel. You know what I'm saying? So we sat down together and we picked out a whole bunch of names. Me and the 11 guys that sat at the gas station, they're drinking too much beer at 4 in the morning. We sat out 11 names and everybody kind of liked that name. And then accidentally I bumped into a painter that wanted to paint the car. And I bumped into an artist who used to do motorcycle tanks that then went to work for Disney. Doing animation, and he did the apes on the side of those cars, and they were the most impressive thing about the car actually was the ape itself. Forget about the rest of the car. It had a pinion snubber and leaf springs and stuff. The ape was great, you know, and it just caught on. Now, it even got to the point where we even had one dragster with that on. Matter of fact, my wife's car had Faye Ray on the right side of the car for a while, which was the woman that King Kong dragged up the top of the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a catchy name. I think the fans are attracted to that more than they are of a guy's name, unless you're Raymond Beadle or Don Garlitz, they're not going to remember you. You know, and if we brought those guys back, the sport would survive right now, by the way.
Yeah. Well, Big Daddy, I mean, was really how he was known. So there was a nickname there. And then Raymond Beadle was just Texas cool. Right. I mean,
very cool.
You know, kind of like the snake. I mean, you know, those guys were just cool for back in their day. And
they're gods.
Yeah.
You know, they're Greek gods. It was what they really are. What they accomplished back then is almost unbelievable in their time. You know, it's sad that they're not being recognized by anybody right now.
Well, our sport is a very much what have you done for me lately kind of thing. So unfortunately, I think it's always been that way. We forget real quick because we're always chasing the next thing. But when did y'all lose the King Kong moniker? Because that is just, to me, that's how I knew you from the earliest days in the dragster. And it just kind of was always there.
Well, I didn't. I think it was I kept it up until about 04, 05. I had a Dodge Dakota truck that Chrysler wanted me to run. This is when they were very interested in the super categories for 2 or 3 years until the Germans bought it. And they didn't like the guy who was operating it, so they weren't very interested anymore. But we kept that Kong going into the middle 2000s until we sold that truck to a fella in Indiana and started to run a 57 Chevy that said the Hot Tamale on it out of Albuquerque, which was a pretty decent car. It never liked me a lot, but it was a well-built car. And then the dragsters, we had one King Kong dragster that we ran in 07 and 08. And that was pretty, that was a Tom Yancer car. Those are really decent cars. That's still my first choice for a car would be that Yancer shock, that double shock setup, because you can take a whole bunch of horsepower where the swing arm cars and the four-link cars go into tire shake. But they, we had that up. So that'd be about 07, 08. I think it was last year. We actually ran that name on the car. Now, the original guy that did it still is out in California doing it. And I had another guy here who was some wolf painting guy in Phoenix who did it very similar to this guy. He even got some detailed photographs from the time to show him how to do it. But the guy that did it originally, you know, the first time I think he did it for like $300. And the last time he did it for $3,000. So he was worth his weight in gold. He was an artist, you know.
Do you think that contributed some of your, I mean, obviously your on-track performance is what your legend's made of, but I think the name definitely helps you become more memorable. Would you agree?
Well, a lot of guys are intimidated by the name in the other lane, even though there's no reason to be intimidated. You know, as well as I do, the guys you usually get beat by the most are the guys that you shouldn't be getting beat by. You know what I mean? I mean, I feel safer running Scotty or Edmund than I am running Joe Shit the Ragman, because this guy's going to take a crack at you. You know, he's going to come close, and you'll get most of your losses come that way. You underestimate your opponent because you don't think he's very good, or maybe you think he's got the wrong tire, and the guy looks too old, he looks too young, you don't like the combination, he'll kick your ass. So you got to watch out nowadays. These guys are good.
Yeah, I remember being with Terry Sullivan, and we came up to your trailer at one of the races, and y'all were talking, and I was just kind of fly on the wall, you know, and you were saying almost the same thing. And I think the quote was, Terry, I think sometimes I just know too much. Like, you're overthinking stuff, and you're basically saying that a rookie that really doesn't pay attention to the weather, the track, this, they get up there and take a lucky shot and actually beat you, and you're kind of going, I'm just in my own head too much sometimes.
That's right. You're right. And Terry's the same way, too. You know, at this point of life, he's probably worse than I am. So what the other day, he's got a throttle stop off his, well, he's $2,000 APD carburetors, right? He doesn't like the size of the air cylinder and the throttle stop and bottom of the carburetor. So he's making another air cylinder that's an eighth inch or quarter inch bigger. It has more volume in it to push the thing closed and open and control it a little bit better. He was going nuts on that. So, okay, you're done. You're worse than I am now.
So kind of on that same note, I remember, so in the early 80s, I would, we'd get to the racetrack and I'd take my camera and I'd go, you know, I'm my early teens, you know, I'd walk around taking photos. And I remember seeing you at the Cajuns one year, and I'm pretty sure it's the year you won first round. My dad red lighted on you, and you went dead 900 and won the TRW money that day. And later on, I rolled by your trailer, and on the wall, you had these charts, like, I don't know if it was like a magic marker or something. What were all that stuff? I was like, I don't know what he's tracking down there, Dad, but he's doing a hell of a lot more than we are.
Those are vapor pressure charts, and what everybody misses running in the South and Southeast, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, is the vapor pressure. It, you really can't look at humidity because humidity is temperature sensitive. You know, humidities do different things at different temperatures, where vapor pressure or grains are more constant. We're just looking at the amount of water that's in the air, and the more water is in the air, the less per square inch oxygen you're getting through your engine. And there were races that we went to, like in Gainesville, were from a one round on Friday would change 1500s in the same air to Saturday. So you'd be out there, be going 970s, and you just were on a 993 the other day because the vapor pressure went from 0.14 to 0.89. And we see that at Topeka. We used to see it at Baton Rouge. It was good for that.
I was going to say, at the Cajuns, you want to track vapor pressure because the humidity just says 100%, right?
All the time, right. And if you've got 100% humidity and it's 35 degrees outside, it's not going to affect the car whatsoever, because the molecules of air are so contracted, they can't hold as much water. But at 100 degrees, and you know as well as I do, oh man, I remember that year. I couldn't remember that year, but you brought it up. I think it was like 100 degrees that year.
Oh, it's 100 degrees every year in Baton Rouge at the Cajuns. It was like Memorial Day weekend. I mean, it was the goofiest thing.
That was the year I think Ed DeStout beat me in the final there. I was, Was that the year where the Superstock Eliminator cars tore the track up?
God, I don't remember. I remember some of it, but I remembered that, Dad went up there and I think he rolled the beams or something. I don't even remember. And you had a free shot first round and turned on the 900. So I told him, came back and told him, I said, you didn't stand a chance against him anyway. And like I said, I just remember seeing you down there with all these charts, and I'm thinking nobody back then that I knew of really tracked a lot of stuff. So I was kind of I was wondering what in the hell you were tracking back then. So you were a little ahead of your time, I believe.
Well, it's back to the same thing we talked about, I think it was yesterday, is that now you can't afford to make enough laps to get that data. First of all, you got to be sitting at a track, you know, where the temperature doesn't change and the barometer doesn't change that much, but the vapor pressure changes. So you got to make that lap when the vapor pressure changes, and then you got to see how much it affects the ET. Then you got to go back and see, well, how much do I got to change the throttle stop to make up for that ET loss? The problem was is the throttle stop adjustment wouldn't be the same in a vapor pressure change that it was in air change. So you had to have a whole bunch of runs, which back then we could afford. There was one year I did 375 runs. And I think we were testing some weekend at Warner Robins, TCI was, and I think we made 75 runs in 3 days, you know, but you can't afford to do that now because you can't afford to rebuild these motors. I mean, it's like some of these bracket racers are showing up to track with two different cars just to have spare parts, you know?
Yeah.
How do you do that anymore? You know,
but you were also dealing with, like, we didn't have the plate style timer throttle stops in the 80s. You're dealing with, you know, a lot of people were using high gear throttle stops where it went into high gear, it shut down a screw under the pedal or all kind of crazy stuff. So it wasn't even like the cars were that consistent back then.
Well, they had the right stop. They're just using it wrong. The high gear thing never worked out well because it was too air sensitive. I mean, you're wide open throttle for on the starting line, you're wide open throttle where you don't want to be wide open throttle. And then you close it up. Now you got a fixed position for probably 75% of the race. So when the air changes, you can adjust for that, but you can't adjust for the first 200 feet of the race where your converter is now stalling 200 RPM higher because the air just changed. So if you would fix the position of the throttle blades all the way down the track from the starting line to the finish line, then you'd be controlling exactly what you want to control. In other words, if the altitude is 2,000 feet and your converter is stalling 6,200 and you open that throttle up because the air just got worse, you continue to have it stalling at 6,200 even though the air is worse. So you have the same amount of power to get down the track with the air being at a different altitude if you're changing it from the starting line to finish line. The problem is, if you don't do that right, there's a guy that's going to go 160 in the other lane, and you're not going to be able to drive with him. So that's where the downside of that happens. You know, you actually had to be dialed to be one over back in the day. You needed to be one over or be one under and dumped it right on, one or the other. So it just depends who you're racing. And then you had to look at your racers. Everybody had to race differently. You couldn't race the same every time because all your opponents race differently. So you had to pay attention. You know, back then you couldn't get that list from the NHRA that had everybody's time runs on it. Remember?
Nobody got all that detail back then, did they?
No, I wish to get rid of all that. It'd be more fun.
So what do you think about these guys that are running the reverse throttle stops that are having such huge success with them? I think Chris Gerritsen in Supercomp and James Kunkel ran his Luminant Supercomp, won a couple of races last year. And then you've got, the green Camaro out of
Tim Nicholson.
Tim Nicholson.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, those guys have gotten really deadly with that combination.
That's a Lenko car.
And the Lenko car.
Well, the only problem with that is you got to be dialed. If you're not dialed, you're doomed. I mean, you got to have all that data we just talked about. And I think when you run a high mile an hour car, you don't have to have all that data because your picture's out in front of you. The problem is when you're going 180, next year there's a guy going 200. So it's and that's what caused our sport to escalate. We kept building motors out of jet fighters to put them in our cars just so we can run more speed. So I don't know how you fix the situation now. I think part of it is with information being given to us by not really by the weather stations, but by Brockmeyer. All the information that's on the ET slip is probably more information than we really need. I mean, we should probably have reaction time 60 foot and quarter mile and be over it, and then have everybody fend for themselves. It'd be a little bit harder, and the cream would rise to the top. But like you said yesterday, anybody with a lot of money can just go out and buy a good setup, and the guy's going to sell it to you is going to tell you how to use it. You know, it's. I guess it's really not fair, but if you got a lot of money, I guess it is fair. You know, there's not many of us left.
Ronnie Sox, Sox and Martin fame in the Pro Stock days, whenever they got rid of the clutch, they went to the clutchless transmissions. He goes, that was the beginning of the end of my run because he was the best at shifting a four speed.
Absolutely.
And taking the skill out of it, and it equalizes the field. So,
right. But, that's
speaking
right.
Speaking of the no time, or less information. So my son, ran his junior at a no prep race. And once elimination started, even in the juniors, they did not give you a time slip. All you got just your whatever showed up on the board. That's all you got. There was no time slips, no reactions, no anything. And that actually was pretty interesting. And I think nowadays they've got some, what do they call them, Jake or Ryan, the ghost races or out the box or something out the gate.
Yeah. Out the gate races is no time runs, dial it. And you don't see anything you've done until the race is over.
Oh, cool.
So you've had no time trial, no anything. So some of that's out there, but and definitely that will make the cream rise to the top.
Yeah, that's a Galen Rollison thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, And the problem you got with that, if you race that in a quarter mile with a high mile an hour car, you got some imbeciles going to be going 200. It's going to be on the brakes, you know. So eighth mile, that would probably be a good type of race for eighth mile race, I would think.
Yeah, be fun. I think there's a lot of the stuff. Yeah, a lot of the old school stuff is kind of coming back in different ways now. I mean, it sounds like Jake's race, he's got a bounty lane where if you want to put up $100 and you win you beat everybody in that lane, you get the bounty at the end of the day and then join the rest of the classes. And there's ghost races. And I think these guys are trying to come up with new ways to have fun with the bracket racing stuff. So, but yeah, you get all the data, it's easy to start dialing everything in and really getting a feel for it. So
one of the things that I've seen and that I didn't like probably the past 15 years is that the super category, the index racers, don't bracket race. And when they do bracket race, they're bracket racing on a stop. And I don't know if it's an ego thing or I'm better than you type of thing. But what I thought it should be done, unless it was just because the index, the mile an hour difference between the cars, what I always thought was a good idea, what they did in Division 5 for a while, they grouped Super Street, Super Gas, and Super Comp together, put them on a ladder, factored a tree, and they all ran together. And the results are what you would have thought. You know what I mean? I think the Super Gas cars through that one season or two seasons or three seasons they did in Division 5 actually prevailed. The Super Streets were second. I think Super Comp was actually the worst. The guy that won it one year had a Super Comp car, but he was just on it that particular. But maybe we can attract some more bracket racers. And we got those index racers to a bracket race. Say, here, we'll give you your index, but you guys are going to all run a second apart. But, you know, if we run you all a second apart, then that payout, which is $5,000 a win, might be $15,000 a win because we're putting three categories together. I don't know if that would work or not, but it did work.
Specialty races in Division 4 where they in Super Street tend to win almost every one of those.
Division 3, it's the Mosier shootout.
Mm-hmm. Is it?
Yep.
Yeah, in Division 5, it was a KD Canopy shootout is what it was at the time. And that's what it was. And that was a cool race. I mean, I'm telling you, they only took 16 cars, which probably was a bad idea. I mean, come on, you got an extra 10 minutes. Let's take 32.
I think a lot of the class guys bracket race on a stop just because of chassis setup and not having to completely rehaul the chassis just from going one discipline to the other.
Yeah, that's why I talked to a lot of the super gas racers. Even Steve Williams from K&M was at the Spring Fling and he had his Corvette Roadster there and he ran it a couple of days. And I was like, hopefully he lets this thing uncorks it in bracket race and we get to see what this thing will do. And I think he went like 520s at 140 something. So, but he said he just had it. He's afraid it was going to just completely stand on the back bumper if he, left full throttle. Right. So he said he just let it come in a little bit and settle down. But I don't know why we're still and I did it too in my cars where these super gas cars, we want them the converter technology, tire suspension is so good we can all kind of light, but we still make these things rear up and rely on the throttle stop to set them down. But it'd be fun to bracket race some of them, I think, if we just
That's the problem with the Don Davis cars, which are wonderful cars. And because the motor is 10 feet high and 40 feet back, I'm exaggerating because I don't know the exact numbers, but they're high. They work extremely well in the super categories. But if you're going to bracket race it, you're doomed. You can't keep them on the ground.
No. So I bracket raced one in Quebec that was 520, and we did a 150-foot wheelie every time we left the starting line.
You know, Don said he told somebody he had one of those cars, and he had like a buddy of mine was racing it for a few years, and he was running 172 in super gas. So he had a good size motor in it. And he was having some issues. So he called Don and was asking about it. And Don said, well, what motor do you have in it? He goes, I got a 600 inch, whatever, runs 170 something. And he goes, no. I built these cars for a 468 big block. I mean, I never built them to run 175 miles an hour.
That's right. That's what he told me. That's exactly what he told me. And he's half deaf, so he can't hear you anyway, but I hope he's doing real well. But some of the guys like there's a Cunningham from Kansas. He bought one of them, I think it was a small block Davis car back about 10 years ago. He couldn't keep it on the ground. So instead of moving the motor down and forward, he took the strut mount and the shock mount and moved it down. So the car was 2 7/8 inches off the ground, the whole car, fixed it immediately. So the car was just barely would turn out the pre-stage and stage ball mount. That's how low he had it. And it solved the problem. He was able to bracket race it. But the car was sitting at about 5 inches before. So instead of moving the 700-pound motor down a couple inches in the chassis, he moved the entire weight of the car down onto the tires, and I guess fixed it. I mean, we should be able to race a car like that. If you look at that car, that car should be able to be saved to go 170 miles an hour easily, you know. But we don't have that anymore. I mean, you know, you got to jump through hoops to get a car tech to be able to do that. But then again, now that I said that, the tracks that we're racing on aren't prepped the same way with the same material that they were 20 years ago. I mean, nowadays you see cars that are going 150 getting loose at 1,000 feet, where back in my day, back in the dinosaur day, nobody got loose. I mean, we ran some races where it was almost raining and nobody got loose, but now everybody gets loose. We just lost one over at Las Vegas a little while ago. Matter of fact, I think wasn't the first spring playing 1,000 foot, and then he moved it back to an eighth mile because you were crashing.
They were 1,000 foot for the first few years. I think they moved them back.
Bristol, right?
Yeah, they moved it back at Bristol. They raced the first day on 1,000 foot, and they pulled it back to eighth mile. And a lot of it was weather, and some of it was I don't know.
I don't know for certain, but I remember there being there was a lot of eighth mile racers that didn't want to run quarter mile, and there was a lot of quarter mile racers that didn't want to. And I think it's a compromise, but. Definitely we're building a lot of horsepower. And so a couple more questions on super gas. So what were your thoughts on when the timers and throttle stop, the plate style car throttle stops with timers came in? That really changed the class dramatically.
Correct. And that started the horsepower race where everybody wanted to run more mile an hour than a car in the other lane because of visibility. You put your opponent out in front of you and you don't have to be dialed as tight. You can hold 3, 4, or 5 and be able to see what you're doing, not turned around and seeing the opponent behind you and the finish line at the same time and the wall. Because when you're turning around, a lot of these guys will turn the steering wheel with them. But that changed the whole spectrum. I tried to balance the center of it. So what I did is I continued to use the under the carburetor stop and I put it on a timer, but I only used 2/3 of the carburetor at the time. So instead of adjusting the timer every time I had to make a change for the change in altitude, I would still adjust the stop. Each flat of the stop meant X amount of ET, and I knew what it was, so I would adjust the stop and leave the timer alone. So it was kind of like using the timer, but you're still adjusting the horsepower from the starting line to the finish line without changing the time in it. And that seemed to work for a while until these guys started to go 170. Then I had to come up with a different plan, like get more money, to keep up with them. You know what it's like.
I've been on both sides. I guess I never was the slowest guy in super gas, but I never was really the fastest. I was usually close to the top, so I never had to look back too far. And it is definitely easier when you've got 10 or 15 mile an hour on a car. You've got a lot of choices to drive the stripe. And for some reason, when somebody's 5 mile an hour faster than you, we all think they're going to blow by us at the ET cone, at the mile an hour cone, and they just never do. I mean, once I figured that out, I'm like, I was a lot better driving at the finish because, everybody's just scared. And so I figured if I wanted to dump somebody, I rarely showed them my front bumper because if they could see me, then they weren't so scared. But if they never saw my bumper in their window, they would just carry it through the back door and break out a lot of times. So,
right. We don't have too many left. That's a scary thing. Everybody's pretty much figured all that stuff out. But it's back to that what we talked about earlier about every racer's got a different program. You got to figure out what their tendencies are. And that's about all you can do nowadays. And, you can get the run slips and find out what they're doing, but a lot of them don't show you what they're doing there. And some of the best racers will change all the time, like Tommy Phillips. I mean, you never know what he's going to do next. He could be 1 over or 8 under. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's a tough one. Yeah, I used to download all the super gas runs for Division 4 after the NHRA website and analyze like time trials and how they raced and what I thought they were set up and just to know my competitors. And it's amazing what Tommy could do. You could see him when he wanted to go dead on, he would go dead on. If he wanted to hold 10, he would hold. I mean, he could do whatever he wanted to do in that car. And then he knew where he was, which was really the tough part. He knew where he was and he knew how to get back to the 90, which is something Terry Sullivan told me a long time ago when I first started super gas racing. He said, you can hold all the numbers you want, but if you don't know how to kill it and get back on the right side of 90, he said, you're worthless. And he said, those guys know how to do that very well. So,
Right. And there's a lot to be said about 3-stage timers where you can do that, not using the 3rd stage, make the 3rd stage manual. Back in the 80s, that's what I did. I run unusual mile an hour in the 80s for a small motor because I was using a manual override at 1,000 foot. So there were many years I was dialed on a 93. I'd show up at the starting line knowing the car would run a 93. If I couldn't beat the guy running a 93, I had to grab that stick. Mm-hmm. I could run an 88 if I grabbed that stick just before 1,000 foot, and I pretty much knew where that was. You're not going to change or add a whole hell of a lot of ET when you start to look at 1,000 foot. maybe a 60-foot new well, but so that thing worked pretty well. You'd be within 1/100th every time you would use it. Anytime you used it, you had to use the brake pedal because you were going to brake out. You know, so you grab that thing and say, "I'm going to take it." Well, you can't take the wind light. You know, you have to use the brake pedal. You're just using that thing to keep this guy out ahead of you because you just dialed at 93 like an idiot, you know. So, but you could do that back then. I mean, you can't do that now because now I'm looking over in the other lane. I'm going back then. I was going, even when I ran Supercom, it's going 160. So I'm looking over. There's a guy's going 175. So that pulling that stick didn't do me any good once the 15-mile-an-hour faster cars I was competing with. So it's just a change of the sport. Maybe the indexes should have changed probably 15 years ago to prevent it. And then everybody went and kept building bigger motors, maybe.
Yeah, that was definitely one of my next questions is what are your thoughts on lowering the index? Is that just going to increase the cost more or and drive some people out?
No. Tomorrow morning. Lower the index tomorrow morning. Nobody's going to drop out. And if he does drop out, it'll drop out for a week. You know, and it's going to be safer. Come on, especially with the super gas cars. You got 1,300 horsepower cars going wide open at 300 feet, you know, with a chassis, an unloaded chassis. When the throttle stop closed, the chassis is unloaded. I mean, there's a whole bunch of forces that shouldn't be there. That four-link bars weren't designed to be on a de-accelerated mode. And you turn that thing back over and you got bars moving at a different rate. You got weight shifting from left to right on a car because of it. I think you'd be far better off with a faster index where the timer would be used further down track or not at all. I think it would be, you know, even they were running over at Las Vegas. They were running that 8th mile deal. I, like an idiot, I watched pretty much all of it at the Spring Fling. Mm-hmm. That race, when those guys are racing, two individual cars took much longer to go down the track than if you're running a 1/4 mile. But they still had to drive completely to the end of the track because it's a 1/4 mile track. And then turn off the track and the other pair can go down. So it actually took them longer to run an 8th mile race than it would have been that 1,000-foot or 1/4 mile race.
Yeah, because they did have to go all the way up the hill pretty much to get off the track.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
they're also sending the next pair as the pair crosses the finish line. We're not waiting for everybody to get off the track like we would at an NHRA race as well.
Yeah, NHRA is overzealous about that. You know, it's there's a lot of things they do that. But then again, there was a couple incidents back in the middle 80s that caused him to do that. It was Jim Finn in the middle 80s that they ran 2 pair past him in Firebird when he was between the 2 photocells on the roof of the car spinning, you know. So after that incident back, I think that was 85, I think it was, they got overcautious, you know, and it's not good for the fans. I mean, the fans don't want to sit and watch a lull on the thing, so I don't know what you got to do to keep their interest. I don't think we have any fans anymore anyway. We're the fans, I guess.
Yeah, we're definitely our own fans in sportsman drag racing. I don't know that it's ever going to be a fan favorite. So, but anyway, no, I just I definitely wanted to have you on. I mean, it was my first national event, and I probably told you this, but my very first national event was the Houston Nationals, I think in like April of 1999. And so I'd have run like 1 or 2 points races and got into the Houston National, and I ran you second round. And I'll never forget it because obviously I couldn't cut a light then. I could go like 40s is all we could get out of the old car. And you treed me, and about 1,000 foot, you pulled up on me and you pulled the smoothest just pedal job I've ever seen. And you just laid your fender right in front of me and railed me the last 300-400 feet. But you were as nice as anybody when I went to talk to you after, and you tried to tell me that you could barely run the number and I almost got by you and all this stuff. You were about as much of a gentleman as I'd ever had seen, and I always appreciated that. But I always learned that, you know, that was just a very smooth driving job. And I was like, man, I want to be that good whenever I do this. And I'm still that one that's down there donkey stomping it all the time and had never probably pulled as smooth a job as you did down there. But it was pretty cool to watch in person, even though I got the losing slip.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, you apologized then too, but it was like, because I told you when you tried to tell me that, I said, this is my first Supergas National, but not my first race. I said, I knew you caught me at about 1,000 foot. You just smiled and you were like, you'll go, I'm sorry. I said, oh, no, sir, you did it just right. You know, so there were a few times I pulled that on some other people and they didn't know it. And I'm thinking, I kind of owe that little move to Sheldon.
Well, a lot of that is comfortability in a car. And that car there, for some reason, the story on that car was when I first wanted that car built, I wanted one of those Chrysler LeBarons, you know. Mm-hmm. I sat in one, and I think it was the fellow from Georgia. I'm trying to think of his name, older fellow. He had one, and I couldn't see over the door panel. You know, I said, well, we're not going to do this. So I built a Daytona. We got a Daytona. The visibility was excellent. I think a lot of it has to do with the visibility. Plus, the seat was at such a head. My head pinned up against the top of the roll cage, so I could see over the hood scoop. I could see over the top of the hood. The hood scoop wasn't very tall. I think a lot of people miss that point of the racing. They'll build a car that was a one-fit-all car or a cookie-cutter car, and a bigger or smaller guy may not be comfortable in it. And he doesn't drive as well, and he thinks he's the problem, or really he's not comfortable in the car. Once you get comfortable in a car, the car's going to do a lot of work for you, you know, and people just don't understand. It's like dragsters. Dragsters are the same way. Remember when those guys had those layback seat and dragsters, and you can't drive those things.
And they were skinny, and they're all bundled up in there.
Yeah, you can't drive that. And Tommy Anser used to build the seats at 57 degrees, I think. And he laid back a little bit, and I didn't like it. And then one of the cars was built at 61 degrees, and that car had so much better visibility for some reason. I just couldn't believe the 4-degree difference in the seat. So when I got the next car after that, I got a bunch of padding. It was 57-degree seat angle. Again, I got a bunch of padding shoved in the back. Well, hell, my head was half out of the roll cage by that time, so that didn't work. So, yeah, I think it's being comfortable in a car. It's just having a car built around you, you know, and whoever's building your car, you need to be sitting in a seat while he's welding to make sure you're comfortable in that car, pedals and shifter. And a lot of people are comfortable doing different things. For me, the trans brake switch has got to be on the shifter. I use my index finger. I don't use my thumb. Oh, wow. Index finger moves faster than your arm or your thumb, but you got to make sure you can't become complacent because your finger doesn't have to work very hard to apply the switch. So you got to know it's applied. And I don't use a button. I use a toggle, or not a toggle switch, a lever switch. And that actually picks up a little bit of reaction time or the button also. So, and that was back in the day, like you were talking about with your car, when you were struggling with a 40 light, I was right there too. And so I started to do all those weird things, trying to pick up the light. And a lot of that little stuff did help. And I ended up not going back, you know, after it started to work. So it's like if you do something bad and you have good results doing something bad, you keep doing something that's bad until you figure out you shouldn't have done it. In this case, it probably was good, and I kept doing it, you know, and nobody else followed the suit except possibly maybe Joe Covert. I think my wife does the same thing. There's a couple guys use an index finger. I think back in the days, a lot of the West Coast guys did, like Ted Kellner and guys like that had those funny switches, those momentary contact switches that were external switches. They use those on a trans brake with the long levers on them. But now the valve bodies are so good. I mean, you know, go ahead.
No, I'm just listening, man, to you talk.
You had a thought there. I saw you had a thought. I saw the gears turning.
No, it's just, I think Dad had he had one of those switches. It was just a piece of aluminum that laid over and touched to try to get the light quick. This was back in probably the 90s. And he found out that his car would take off sometimes before, while he's still holding it. Well, what he realized, if you push too hard, the little Teflon that it was set on would bend, and it would actually not touch the contact, and it would just, so he kept red lighting and didn't even realize why half the time. So they had a lot of tricks back in the old days to try to get to a light, and nowadays it just is so much easier than what it used to be.
Well, yeah, we got giant tires, and we got fluid release valve bodies. We got torque converters that are actually softer than they were 20 years ago. They multiply less torque, but we have bigger motors. So it doesn't affect their reaction time at all. So now you can have your cake and eat it too. And I think maybe that's going to be one of the problems in bracket racing. You give all these guys information, you let them cross over and stuff like that. You're only running an eighth mile, and the last three rounds, if you've got 100th package, you're junk. You know, it's got to get to the point where it's going to be a little bit more competitive, where you don't have to be perfect every single time down the track. You know, and if you look at any races you ever were really good at, or you won or did really good, you always had one round that you probably shouldn't have won. And you look back and say, man, I shouldn't have won that round, you know. And I had two of them like that in my lifetime. I had one at Sonoma and one at Brainerd when a car actually killed in the starting line and the guy in the other lane broke out. But that's happened twice to me. And in both of those races, I won the entire race. So you just got to be lucky. You know, you just got to have, you know, it's one of those things. You can prepare all you want, but luck's the final determining factor. With good preparation, maybe you'll get a little bit of luck.
Well, cool. So what are you up to these days? Because you haven't raced in the last few years, right?
No. It got too expensive, the whole picture. I got some access to cars. We may start again here in a little while. I'm thinking rather going bracket racing rather than chasing NHRA stuff, because there's no carrot in the NHRA stuff anymore. It's just you're at a track for 5 days to win $2,000 or something. You know, it doesn't work, but I've been still doing transmissions in the garage. I do a lot of power glides, not a lot of them. I used to do quite a bit. And now it's a lot slower because a lot of people aren't racing. A lot of people have quit, But that's about all I'm doing. Doing some power glides and getting them in big. Usually the guys buying the power glides now are the big engine guys. You know, the guys running top drags or top sportsmen. They're the ones that are using up the transmissions because of their horsepower. So we get a lot of those guys, a lot of those guys that have money. I mean, guys like you and I, we'll build a transmission. Shit, it probably lasts us two seasons anymore, you know, without having a problem at all. And when you send it back to Terry, he takes it apart, there's nothing wrong with it, he gives it back to you, you know. So the parts are a lot better now than they were 20 years ago. Most of the parts are, I should say, except possibly maybe the bands are the only weak issue now compared to 20 years. The stock band still being the best band in the power glide. It's changed drastically. And even in the past 5 years, it's changed drastically. But back to what you were saying earlier, there's a lot of guys that I've been talking to in the last few months that are just dropping out of that NHRA deal because of the length of time they're there, the payout. It's just not as much fun as it used to be. You know, they're just not doing it. You know, it's back to the sanctioning body not doing its job.
Yeah, and it's weird because, you know, I think not last year, but the year before, there were several points races across the country. And I know Indy had like 700 cars and Topeka had 600. I mean, there's still some of these races where there's 600-700 cars at a points race for basically what, running $1,800 or $1,500 to win or whatever it is, and a little bit of contingency. And then they're fighting to get in to have 8 grade points to get into a national event, which used to pay 15 to 20 that might pay 5 to 10 now, depending on how many decals and stuff. So it's still, I think it's out there. It's just people are traveling longer distances to go to these races. And it seems like there's maybe few, there's the same people are showing up. A lot of the same people are showing up week to week, maybe, but they're definitely getting a lot of car counts and, you know, those quotas, as much as I hate them, because it's pretty much kicked me out of, you know, running Super Comp and running NHRA Nationals, which I love. I'm not going to go to 7 or 8 points races a year. I just don't have the time to go do that to go run 2 nationals. So it's kind of kicking me out, and I hate that. But on the other hand, it seems to have rejuvenated the points races where more and more people have to go just to have a shot to make some of these races, except on the West Coast where everything's shut down, it seems like.
Right, because the tracks are so far apart. But I think what you're talking about right there, the limitation of very expensive super category cars or any cars, super stock, super cast, super comp in the fields is pretty much the demise of the sport. Because once that happened, the vendors quit coming. And of course, the entries were less, so the NHRA had to raise costs somewhere. So they went to the vendors or trying to get money from the rest of their entities to get their final amount of money or the final nut that they want to earn. So once the vendors were coming to tracks and their customers weren't at the track, which were their customers, they quit going. When they quit going, the payout became less and it just snowballed. And you could almost watch it on a yearly basis. And at some point after the market fell in, I don't think it is associated with it at all because these guys want to race. I mean, the guys that we race with and you race with, we want to race. But if we got 8 points race and we live in California and we got 1 points race in April and 1 in September, what are we going to do for 8 months? You know,
the other thing I think it's, Sheldon, that's a problem that I hear is that if you're a super gas car, you probably are not a very good bracket car. I know there's still a few out there. My buddy Chris Edison, he runs his super gas car here in Texas all the time, and he does well with it. But there's very few true super gas cars that are racing all the time that would be a great bracket car. You got a stocker, a super stocker. I mean, that's not a great bracket car. I talked to Justin Lamb last week or a week before in Vegas, and he made the finals, I think, one night in the pro class, which is the no box. And he said, hell, he goes, I'm at a disadvantage. He said, my car's moved 0.07 today from the first pass to the last. He said, I've just been driving it, dialing it. I know my car. But that super stocker, as much as we think that's a badass car and you always see it running the number, he had a pretty big window that probably a lot of bracket racers around the country would think would be a very, you know, good bracket car. So if you're trying to be purpose-built for super stock or stock or some of these others, I just don't think you have the tool to go bracket race. So it almost excludes you a little bit because it's taken such a specialized vehicle to win a bracket race or to win a stock eliminator race.
Yeah, you may be right, because you're doing everything aggressive to obtain reaction time, which you don't want in a bracket car because you have a delay box or on a 5/10 street. You don't need that. So you got a very aggressive converter. You got a lot of gear ratio. You got an oversized tire in most cases. You got a 632-inch motor, which you don't need either, with a giant cam. You're right. I mean, the cars could become competitive, but you would have to change the tune-up considerably in a car. You'd have to change a converter before you went to the track. And change the timing. It may even run the thing full length of the track on a throttle stop at maybe a 50% carburetor position, you know, with under the carburetor, like a old Dead and Bear or a one stop under the carburetor in a fixed position. So you're not going 480s. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if you're going 480 in a door car, you're not consistent. There's no way,
yeah.
You know, you got to, and that's why you have a dragster, you know, but if you can get a door car in 550, 520 area, maybe you're going to be more consistent. The folks do with that old Cavalier. Is that a Cavalier? Is that still a Cavalier?
Cobalt. Stock car. Yeah. But I mean, even like my car, when I called Kevin at Hughes and said, "Hey man, I need a converter." He goes, "Okay, first question." He asked everybody, "You want to be good at bracket racing, or are you going to do 890?
That's right.
So it's going to lean, even in a dragster, it's going to lean one way or the other. Which one do you want to repeat the best? So it definitely, I think that does create some of that. It's NHRA racer and versus a bracket racer. I don't think it's intentional. I think you're just trying to have the best tool for the job. And you'll see some people dabble, you know, Justin did pretty well last week at the Fleeing, but, you know, obviously not with the best tool for that particular race, mm-hmm. but put him in a super stock race and he's, you know, 5-time world champ. So.
Right. Exactly. Well, you can do it. You just got to work.
Anything else you'd like to add, or guys, anything that we didn't cover? This has been, you know, a little bit super gas heavy today. Not quite in y'all's wheelhouse.
This is probably just educational hour.
Yeah, it should be a little bit more bracket heavy because that's where we all came from. You know what I mean? That was the inception of the super categories were from the bracket categories. They just let the super categories get out of control. And I guess that's the whole point of the whole thing. If they weren't out of control, we'd probably have more super gas cars. You know, but then again, if we have more supercast cars, they can't get in the race anyway. So I guess it's irrelevant. It's
they can run points races.
Yeah, you run points races for $1,800 a year for 5 days. I understand. You know, it's but I wasn't intending to be supercast heavy because I haven't run much supercast in years and years. But it's the same that all those cars back then when I started were all good bracket cars. You know, and they're probably still good bracket cars. Actually, that's kind of interesting. Those cars really don't become outdated. A good car with a four-link suspension is going to run forever. It's going to be consistent, we discussed, tires and converters, the whole game right now.
Yeah, you know? I think that's the popularity with bracket racing is there's just so many cars. You look at Nick Hastings, who's running the little T1000 Pontiac Chevette-style car, and, I mean, he just keeps winning at the highest levels. And, you know, once you get your car and you know your car, you get it repeating with the equipment that's out there today and the technology – and you drive it like he does. I mean, he's down to 6 cars in this million at the Spring Fling Million. He was down to 3 at the Guaranteed Million. So
I think you're right. I think you hit it right on the head. And I think I saw a lot of that with racers like Steve Cohn, where they'd run their car for 2 years. They finally got good in year number 2 and they sell it because they can make some really good money on it. And they build another car and they went ahead and struggled for another 2 years. I mean, you could stay in the same car for like ever, like Nicholson up in Kansas and that old Camaro with the Linko in it. He's killer. He's brutal. Even bracket racing, he's brutal. You know, so
how long has he been running that car, Sheldon? He's had that car forever.
Well, I started racing Division 5 in 82 or 3, whatever it was. He's had it back then. So it was a high school car, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
I think, yeah. Yeah, and that's how to do it. I mean, by that time, you have a rapport with a car. You know every molecule in it. You're going to do good in it. I think the reason – I don't know why we change cars. I mean, we try to improve, but – the technology and the chassis haven't changed all that much. The technology has been changed all in the engines, you know, and transmissions and the valve bodies. I mean, our first four-link, what's the name? The first four-link, I can't think of his name right now. The guy from Australia, most of the four-links are all similar to themselves, except when you go to the swing arm where you X the bottom of them. All those cars are similar, you know, so that hasn't changed all that drastically. It's the drive lines that have changed, so. I don't know what we do to improve what we're doing, but I think somehow we got to go back to ancient history and start getting the old people back that did it years ago and get them back racing again. But we have to do something to keep this thing going because we're going to run out of racetracks pretty soon.
Yeah, I think racetracks are going to run out before racers because we've seen, you know, we had 440 in Vegas recently. And I mean, we've got some big races coming up this year. They'll have probably 500-600 cars at. So in the bracket racing world. So, yeah, we definitely need some more races out on the West Coast. Those guys, every one of them tell me how far they have to travel to go to one race. It's like 18 hours here, 12 hours there. I'm
thinking, right.
And why do you don't race as much?
That one 18-hour track you're talking about is Sonoma, and that's not going to race this year either. So you're down to Las Vegas, Tucson, and Fallon, Nevada. Salt Lake being gone, Pomona, they don't race. Denver is the next step east. You're better off getting your car and driving to Texas. There's a bunch of tracks there. Yeah. You know, that might be the safety. I think that's why the Midwest is doing so well, because there's tracks everywhere. You know what I mean?
I think so.
And, yeah, there's seven within 4.5 hours.
From my house in Fort Worth, within 3 hours, there's 6 or 7 tracks.
Mm-hmm. So you guys live in heaven then? Because
Life's good for all of us.
Yeah, it's terrible here.
I used to dirt race, and it's even better too. I mean, on the relations to racetracks, there's 3 tracks within 30 minutes of me.
Yeah.
I mean, here it's flat. There should be tracks everywhere. It's flat as a board everywhere. You know, I don't understand it. You know, the weather's good 12 months out of the year, and there's no tracks. You know, it's
not in Indiana, it's not, but in Texas, it sure is.
Oh, Texas is good. Yeah. Of course, I've been at Houston for a race where it actually snowed.
I was there.
You were there. That's right.
we woke up the next morning and it snowed overnight. I don't even know what time of year that was. It was stupid.
It was March.
It was April. Was it March?
Because they had a freaking ADRL race that same weekend at the other Houston track. That's right. I was there. I got snowed out.
And we turned that thing, backed it into the wind because the motorhome was about to blow over. And we stayed there for the whole week in the pit area until it all melted. I think they raced it the next week.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of guys that left. I like Tucson. Houston. I mean, I even crashed a car once there, and I still like the track. You know, it's, I don't know why. I like it way more in Dallas. I wonder what that is.
This guy was telling me yesterday he was testing his testing story in Kennedale. And I was like, I just was at Kennedale earlier this year. Ryan's race was at the top end of that track.
Yeah, I grew up at Kennedale.
He was asking what happened to Green Valley. I said, it's not there anymore.
So I live about a mile from Green Valley, or where Green Valley used to be. There is a neighborhood that sits on top of it now.
That's what I thought.
Oh, boy.
Terrible. Everything's tore down now. You can still, there's like a little gap in there where there's no houses on. There's just like almost like a little park area. And you can see where the bridge used to be.
Yep.
You can see where it was. And I guess where the starting line was is still there. But I mean, if you went by there, you would never know that there was ever a racetrack there.
I was so young. Remember that track.
We tested there also. I can't remember what it was for, but I was impressed at the amount of tracks. And there's one still in Sealy, isn't there?
It's still there, but it's not for the public. Hennessy bought the land and the track, and they just used it to test cars on that they built.
Okay. They had it for sale not long ago for like $4 or $5 million.
They had it for sale for 5 times its worth.
Yeah, that was the closest to me, Sheldon. That's probably about 45 minutes from my house.
Well, isn't that closer to how far is it? Well, that's closer to San Antonio, isn't it?
Well, it's only like 45 minutes from the west side of Houston. And to go to Baytown, I have to drive an hour I'm on the west side. I have to drive all the way through Houston to the east side to go to Baytown. So it's like an hour. It's not bad. Not bad at all. But Sealy would be nice because it's close. It's a cool little track, but it's a small little bracket track. But
what about the one over on the east side of the state? I was trying to think of the guy's name that ran it.
Hallsville?
Hallsville. What happened to Hallsville?
Neighborhoods on top of it as well. Literally, when you pull into it's got a big entrance, and it's got 2 roads that come in and out of it, and a median in the middle. Each road is a lane.
Oh no! Yeah. Oh no!
Oh man!
It's like they shitted on it too, because it's called like Raceway Estates or something.
Oh no! Oh, really? Geez. That's terrible. See, there you go. There's what the sacrilege right away. Like I said. Yeah. I mean, these old drag racers are Greek gods to me. I mean, the amount of time and money they put into the sport years ago, and I'm not talking just top fuel racers. I'm talking about bracket racers. I mean, their guys are just unbelievable drivers. That had very limited, like Johnny Labuse. That man put everything together with an impact gun, not a 3/8 impact gun, a 1/2 inch impact. I've watched him do it. He goes out and wins races all the time with this stuff, you know? I mean, there was a good group there. It's the kid does pretty good too, Johnny Jr., I guess, but.
I'd say so.
Yeah, it's a tough deal. I mean, you got to just keep your head down and keep going, I guess. Some of these tracks will come back, I would guess.
All right. You need to work on like a bottom bulb class or something, a car, so you can get back to bracket racing or something.
I could do that.
Get you a little Dodge and yeah.
I did some bottom bulb when I ran Top Dragster, and I liked it. It's good. Yeah. It's good.
Bottom bulb stuff's fun. Yeah, all right, Sheldon, we're going to cut you loose, man. I appreciate you coming on. It's been great talking to you. Enjoyed it thoroughly, and wishing you and Crystal all the best, man.
Okay. I hope I didn't bore you guys to death with all the old stuff, but.
No, not at all.
All right. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, bud.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you at a race someday.
That was cool.
I would ask if anybody had any questions, but nobody should have a question after that.
No.
Hey, all questions answered. Hang on. I have a whole page of questions. I was prepared.
I bet you do, bud.
Gary, what is that on that paper? Did you spill something?
Nope. Did not drool on the paper.
No. Oh.
That's a cool dude, man. No, there's nothing on there but ink. I was afraid that you guys may not know who the hell Sheldon Gecker was, so I was going to make sure I was prepared to carry this one if I had to. So, and then I kind of geeked out a little bit, which I do.
He's kind of just like Bastianelli. He kind of just carries himself. While we're on this thing, new topics this week, we're going to start a Get Ryan a Job campaign. Because Ryan has announced today he's officially no longer with Ardmore Dragway, and he's going to go hit the road. So if you are if you've got a points race, Ryan will show up and announce it. We need to get Ryan a job.
I thought this was his job, Jake, and now I see he's cheating on me.
Well, I mean, this job does enable you to get stimulus checks if you are yes. if you are wondering.
Yeah, but actually it doesn't, because there's no check stubs, so you don't file taxes.
You'd have to get paid to have a check stub, right?
Yeah. No.
No, man.
I 9 o'clock this morning, I put in my resignation, Ardmore Dragway. I don't know. Like, it sucks, kind of, because I've been there on and off for so long. I mean, I started there when I was 19 years old, and here I am at 27. So, obviously, super excited because now I get to go, I guess, kind of chase the dream. This is what I've wanted to do from the get-go. So, it is scary because now I can't – like, there's nothing else to blame. It's just me. Like there's – all decisions are mine.
Hey, I feel you.
Yeah, no. And, I mean, I made a list of all the stuff that I kind of want to accomplish, and we're going to start checking stuff off that list.
Hey, where does getting married fall on that list?
But don't even get me in this trouble right now. It's on there. It's probably not as high up as it is for the other, but it's
can you add running a profitable podcast to that list? So hopefully we can have that as a goal too.
Oh man, I'm sitting here waiting for it, bud.
What was that?
I almost had a fish on the hook the other day too. I'm like, oh my God, somebody's asking about paying to be on the podcast to promote something. And I thought we were going to hook the first big mouth bass, but got off the line.
Yep. So if you are listening this far into this podcast, an hour and 30 minutes now, if you see any ad whatsoever for a job on Facebook, I don't care if it's sweeping the bathroom at a gay bar, please send it to Ryan.
I'm about to get so much fucking shit.
I can't wait. Anybody but me, please.
Oh my gosh.
That is so fun.
But yeah, no, I'm booked up fairly decent through the next couple of months. And then, the summer gets a little sketchy, so I need y'all to start braving the heat in some places and put on some big money races and pay me to announce them.
Well, what else, guys?
About it, I think.
Go ahead.
Me and Tara leaving tomorrow to go to London Dragway for the CP Promotions race there. I've never been to London Dragway.
So me either.
I get to check another one off the list. That'd be kind of cool. And then, I don't know.
Really, speaking of the races that you announced, we didn't really talk about, I guess last week we didn't have a chance, but the million, the guaranteed, Great American Guaranteed Millions having a date and venue change, which I don't think we've even discussed at all.
Yeah, some complications, I think, over at Memphis, as just from what I'm hearing, this is not Great American approved or anything like that. A lot of the upper management in and out, putting in their 2 weeks and things of that nature.
Number one and number two there.
Yep. So
let's see ya.
Moving the Dream Team race back to Holly Springs, where at least I thought it went really well last year. I think everyone enjoyed themselves. I'm a big Holly Springs fan. And then the million, there's a couple different places getting thrown out there. Nothing for sure. No timeline for sure. I think I talked to Britt today, but they were trying to get something finalized in the next couple of weeks, maybe. But as of right now, I have no clue where this thing's going. It could end up on the fucking moon at this point. I don't know. But I know wherever they choose to go, it'll be a nice facility, and they're going to put on a quality race.
I know wherever they choose to go, Cole will not be cutting grass on Wednesday.
Yes. No, he will not. And he did that last year.
Yeah. So, but Holly Springs ended up being a really great race last year, and I think everybody was a little worried, and all I heard was really, really positive stuff.
Yeah, there was
a little bit of weather.
Well, there was a stigma going into Holly Springs that, like, it was the world's shortest shutdown, and I think a lot of people went, and I think when you say that, people think like the track might be a little honky-tonk or something. It's a pretty nice facility. In all actuality, Jabbo does a really good job there.
Hey, if you see him, if you get there, one of y'all, just tell him we're still waiting on those 5K junior results that he would promised us, you know, a month ago.
You're probably not going to get them, bud.
I'll tell you right now, Jabbo does not give two shits what results you want, because Jabbo's going to have another 5K junior race in the same. Okay, he's going to say.
Okay, so let's talk about that. It ain't about what the effing promoter wants, okay? It's about what you want to do for the kids or for the racers that came and supported your effing race. And yeah, this is me starting to get mad. At some point, you got to realize that people are coming and paying you money and supporting your damn race, and they want some attention for what they do. And all you got to do is print out your little run sheet, and you just email that over to GaryDon@dragjam.com. And you just maybe tag us on a photo or take a damn decent photo of your winners.
Jabbo's in his 60s.
It doesn't matter.
I mean, I don't know if he does the technologies very much.
There's people, guys, promoters, racetracks, if you expect people to show up, what did Evan Bader tell us last year? If you want it to be a big deal, you got to make it a big deal. If you want people to show up and support your races, do a minimum amount of work to help them out. And I could just tell you, those kids, that was a disservice to the kids. And it's not personal against Jabbo. He's not trying to, but those kids won't recognize for what they do. And that was one of the toughest races of the year for those. And it really bothered me that we weren't able to showcase them and give them the credit that they deserve. But this really is more about race promoters in general. It's just getting frustrating when there's people out there trying to help you and you won't even take free help, much less just do the basics, which is, I mean, it just isn't that hard, people.
There's Ryan a job offer, social media, Holly Springs Motorsports.
I bet it pays well.
I bet it pays. I guarantee you, Jake will have a social media person. He will make sure when you're at the working man's 10 grand that people know it and that he's got the right people in place. And there's a lot of promoters doing that. CP's doing it. The Fling does it. SFG puts out press releases. I mean, Loose Rocker, you name it. I mean, these guys that are doing it, that are having big car counts, are, you know, they're taking care of those racers. And there's just, it's just a little bit, man. It doesn't take much. Get one of the parents to help. Get one of the racers.
I hired two of them.
So that's my rant. I'm going to stop there before I really get wound up.
No, now that I don't have a job, I can actually go to Jake's race.
Yeah.
Look at this.
Hell yeah. I could tell you, judging by social media reactions on Drag Champ, that Jake's going to have a pretty good crowd.
Well, good. More people to cave my fucking head in.
Hey, but you'll be a house car. You'll be a house car.
No, we're gonna go over this whole deal. I have a Facebook Live video of me paying my own fucking entry before I get thrown into this fucking house car bullshit.
Oh my god!
No,
man,
there's not such a thing.
No,
we stayed really nice for the whole episode until this last 10 minutes, and we've fallen back into our hoodlum antics. But that's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah, the real me comes out.
I just didn't give y'all a chance to talk earlier. I apologize for that, but I had a lot of questions I wanted to ask.
Hey, this is your world, Gary. We're just living in it.
No, man. I only have this podcast because of you two, man. You both came on one to do this, and I'm just holding the coattails. So, and every now and again, I get to do one podcast in the blue moon. So,
hopefully you get one a year, Gary. That's all you fucking get.
Yep. Hopefully people will listen and come back the next week and listen to y'all do some real interviews. So, all right. Well, I got to run. It's been fun. No, it's been real fun.
It has been real fun. Yeah.
All right. We'll see you guys next week.
Have a good one.